This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1995, Lisa Dickey set out on what she thought would be a once-in-a-lifetime trip. She went with a photographer to a lighthouse at the Russian border with North Korea. They then trekked 5,000 miles across the nation. Along the way, she spent time getting to know Russians from different walks of life, including a rapper, a farmer, and members of an isolated Jewish community, to name just a few. She decided to relive that experience and returned in 2005 and again in 2015 to find out how the lives of Russians had changed over the decades and how their relationship with the U.S. had shifted. Lisa Dickey gathered the narratives in a new book called Bears in the Streets, Three Journeys Across a Changing Russia. She's going to give a talk tomorrow evening at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, but first joins us in our studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Tell us about this. Every 10 years you've been going back, but you hadn't planned on doing this. Tell us about the original trip in 1995.
So the original trip came about, I was actually living and working as a freelance journalist in St. Petersburg, Russia. And I heard about this guy, an American photojournalist, who wanted to make this big trip across Russia. And he wanted to start with this remote lighthouse and then travel, you know, the 5,000 plus miles across and just meet ordinary Russians and take photos and do stories. And he needed somebody who could just drop everything and go with him for 3 months and do this. And so Gary and I did this whole trip, and we stopped in these various cities and met people from all walks of life, as you say. And it really was an amazing trip. And we actually did a real-time web travelogue, which in 1995 was no small feat.
Yeah, the technology in 95, just to get photos uploaded and downloaded, it was a...
Well, you know, I couldn't... Once he told me that's what he wanted to do, I thought, okay, well, now I'm going across Russia with an insane man, because how do you possibly do that, right?
Yeah, right.
But, and then he showed me this ginormous camera, and he took my picture, and he popped a little thing out and put it into his MacBook, and then my face came on the screen, and I just flipped. I couldn't believe it. I didn't even know that technology was in the works, much less ever had seen it.
Did it take like 20 minutes, though? So line by line, you're...
It was actually pretty fast, it was really surprising to me. And so, you know, the fact that I had never seen it, you can imagine what the Russians in the middle of Siberia thought when we were showing them this stuff.
So tell us about that and the amount of planning that had gone in. To what extent did you sort of map this thing out, or how much of this was making the road by walking, as they say?
It was a lot of making the road by walking, yeah. We knew we wanted to start at the lighthouse in Vladivostok, and then there were a couple things we knew we wanted to do. We wanted to go to this place called Birobidzhan, which had been set up by Joseph Stalin in the late 1920s as a sort of homeland, quote unquote, for Jewish people. And then beyond that, we knew we wanted to interview a farmer at some point. We knew we wanted to try to find a community of gay people that we could talk to about what it was like to be living as a gay person in Russia. And beyond that, we just kind of made it up as we went along. I mean, we had no money. We were just doing it all on a shoestring. So a lot of it was, we're in this town, and well, that next town looks like a good place to go. And we'd ask everybody we ran into, do you know anybody in that town who might be able to put up a couple of weary travelers and talk to them?
Fascinating time in Russia. This is 1995. So we're sort of just into this new period now. The Soviet era had ended, but not long before. What kind of reception did you get?
So in 1995, if you recall, the Soviet Union had fallen just 4 years earlier. And friendship was breaking out all over, right? They had President Yeltsin and we had President Clinton, and no longer was it the Cold War. And, you know, it was a pretty comfortable relationship at that point, especially in comparison to what it had been for, you know, the previous five decades. And so, you know, I'm traveling across, and number one, a lot of people hadn't ever met an American before. And number two, they're like, wow, you're coming through and you're asking us what we think and you want to talk to us. And so for the most part, it was a very comfortable reception. The one exception was the very first place that we went, which was the lighthouse. And the woman who was the wife of the lighthouse caretaker was really nervous about us poking around. And one of the reasons was it's technically a military installation. And also Vladivostok for decades had been a closed city because it was a big military base and military port. So she freaked out a little bit. But she was kind of the only one. I mean, for the most part, people were very welcoming. They were very generous. They'd, you know, have us in and feed us and give us a bunch of vodka and tell it, you know, answer all our questions. So
how were they? And they were curious. It's interesting to see how much they wanted to know from you about what Americans thought about Russians.
Yes. Yeah. They always are very curious about what the Americans think about them. And actually, you know, over time, that has sort of morphed. On the third trip in 2015, The title of the book, Bears in the Streets, actually speaks to this. There were a lot of people who said, well, you Americans all just think we have bears wandering in the streets here. And I kind of laughed the first time I heard it, but the sixth or seventh time I heard it, I thought, well, this is really a thing. You know, they think that we don't respect them. And that's a really big deal for the Russians.
Well, there's always this question whenever there's a kind of geopolitical tension, as there was in the Cold War, sort of how the people in each country feel about the system, the government, the Soviet Union, the United States of America, and whether or not they can kind of disaggregate or separate the people from the politics. And I wonder if you got any sense of that. First of all, what they thought of the United States of America. Was it a demon republic that was about to, you know, sort of
Well, you know, in 2015, certainly people had a lot of suspicion of the United States. Yeah. They were not fans of Barack Obama. And by that, I mean, they really, really, really were not fans of Barack Obama.
It was because we had imposed sanctions.
Yeah, they were not happy about the sanctions. The sanctions are actually a really galvanizing thing for the Russians, you know. Like, we imposed these sanctions after everything that happened in Ukraine. But if you talk to the Russians, they would say, like, all right, well, this is, you know, we don't need your this and that, and we don't need your money, and we don't need your food imports, and we're fine, and you guys are going to see just how strong we really are. But in terms of separating, like, the people from the government, one of the things that people said to me really consistently on this trip was, look, we don't like what your government is doing. We don't really like your president. But we are really happy that you're here. We're really happy to welcome you and to talk to you. And, you know, they always were very appreciative that somebody was sort of coming through and asking them what they thought about things.
So let's find out about a few of these people. What'd you find out? The lighthouse keeper, when they finally did talk, what was the story there?
So in 1995, you know, they both were very nervous, but they opened up. They had me in and they fed me a meal and we talked. And you know, they'd been taking care of this lighthouse for decades, and previously, to their taking care of it, the father of the guy, the husband, had taken care of it. So it had been in the family for years and years. And the interesting thing about that lighthouse was it really was sort of felt like at the end of the earth. We had to take a taxi down the road, and then the road stopped, and then we had to hike down this sort of dirt road. And then we got there, and there was nobody there. 10 years later, when we came down, it had been turned into a public beach. And so now people were coming down, and there was like a little restaurant and a cafe, and there was even a discotheque in the evening. And so there was a lot of people who'd come down. And then this time around, it was even more so. There was just like so much had been built up down there, and new homes on the road down, and it was paved all the way down. And you'd see jet skis buzzing around by the lighthouse. And that was definitely weird. So it was definitely a lot of new development.
And you tell a funny story in 1995 about just getting the attention of anybody, because you got to the lighthouse and nobody home.
Yeah, nobody was there. And actually, it was a funny thing where Gary and I get down there. And, you know, I barely know Gary, and Gary doesn't speak any Russian. And so I'm kind of in charge of doing all the translating. And we see these two old guys out in the water in these little rubber dinghies, and they're fishing. And Gary says to me, you need to yell out to those guys and tell them to come in. And I said, Gary, no, they're fishing. Like, leave those guys alone. And he's like, do it, do it. And so, you know, I'm screaming at these guys who are thinking, what in the world? Like, who are these people showing up yelling at us to come in? But they finally did row in. And, you know, they said to us, well, just go up and knock on that door. And the lighthouse keeper lives there. And so we went and had that first conversation.
You also told us a minute ago about the Jewish community, this homeland, as it were, a segregated community set up by Stalin, Birobidzhan, right?
Yes, Birobidzhan.
Tell us more about that.
So it's the Jewish Autonomous Region. It was set up by Stalin, and they basically, you know, created this place where the Jews in European Russia and from wherever else, because there were actually Jewish people who came from all over the world. There were Jewish people who came from Argentina and Europe, and some from the United States even, to go. Because this is pre-Israel. There was no Jewish state in Israel. And so, you know, it was this promised land where they had these posters and brochures that they would make that had showed these smiling people harvesting wheat in this beautiful sunshiny place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they get there. And if you look at Birobidzhan on a map, it is really the middle of nowhere. It is just north of China. It's not close to anything. And the winters are freezing, the summers are boiling hot, and there are clouds of mosquitoes, and it is not a place that you would ever really want to live. But at any rate, so Stalin offers, you know, money for people to bring their families out there. So they come out and they start building this community. And at its peak, there were tens of thousands of Jewish people living there. But then there was, you know, after the Second World War, there was a lot of repression against the Jews, and the community dwindled. And by the time Gary and I got there in 1995, there was one tiny synagogue where this guy named Boris would lead prayer services with the Russian Orthodox Christian women.
Wow.
So it was really this quirky, strange place that just felt like a ghost of its former self.
Tell us about the conversations you had in 95 and how they changed over time.
Yeah. So, you know, we're there in 1995 and I thought, well, this is one of the most fascinating places I've ever been. But, you know, when I decided to go back 10 years later, I thought there's not going to be a single Jewish person left here because everybody was leaving. And the one strongest organization that was there in 1995 was an organization that was helping people get out. And so I thought, well, there's going to be no Jewish community at all. So in 2005, when I got there for the second trip, I was absolutely stunned to find there was a brand new synagogue. There was a rabbi there who had moved there from Israel, and there was a really thriving Jewish community. And the number of students who were studying Yiddish and studying Jewish history in the school, in the main school there, had doubled. And it was really surprising to me, but a lot of money had flown in. This was actually one of the major differences between the 1995 trip and the 2005 trip, is that the Russian economy had started doing much, much better. In 1995, the economy was just in a shambles. The ruble had collapsed. People had lost their life savings. Everybody was really freaked out, and they were trying to figure out a way to adjust to this new reality of capitalism. In 2005... between 95 and 2005, the price of oil tripled. And Russia is a very oil-based economy. And so suddenly there's money, and it starts flowing into all these towns and cities. And one of the places it flowed into was Little Birobidzhan.
But why were people moving back? I mean, that's curious. That money would flow in there, but you're talking about Jewish communities and people coming to Russia now from other parts of the world and other parts of Russia.
But they weren't, actually. Here was the interesting thing, was I talked to the woman who was the head of the school, and I said, well, it seemed like everybody was leaving. And she said, the more people that left Birobidzhan, or the more Jews that left Birobidzhan, the more that remained. And I said, well, what kind of a riddle is this? What do you mean by that? And she said, well, what I mean is for years and years, people hid the fact that they were Jewish. Mm. And now they are opening up about it and they're reclaiming their Jewish heritage. And that is why, even though so many people left, it wasn't that people returned, although some did. But really what it was people started to become more open about the fact that they were Jewish.
And move into this community to some extent, or had they always been there? I mean, obviously, this is a closed community.
They'd always been there, yeah.
Well, yeah. So you also met a rapper, MC Pavlov.
Yeah, he was a character. He was great.
That's like Snoop Drooly Drool. I'm sorry, I had to say that.
Snoop Drooly Drool.
MC Pavlov. So yeah. Tell us about him.
He was great. He was a fascinating character. We wanted to do his story because, you know, the story we'd done in the city before, that was a very sad one. It was about a young man who had been a soldier in the army, Russian army, and he'd been killed in action in Chechnya. This was 1995, and Chechnya was a very big topic of conversation. So we get to Moscow, and we're thinking, well, what story can we do? Because we didn't always know which stories we were going to do in which cities. And somebody said they could introduce us to this rapper. And rap was really just not a thing in Russia in the mid-90s at all. And so we thought, well, that'll be fascinating. So we met him, and he just had this amazing vitality. He was just a fascinating guy, and he was a great rapper. And so we went to see one of his shows, and he told us all about that. And he was actually a Hare Krishna also, and a vegetarian, so he's just a very super unusual guy.
Right.
And so we had a really good time with him, getting to know him. And he actually had one of the sort of more difficult twists. When I went back 10 years later to see him, I was supposed to meet him in a metro station, and I was waiting and waiting. I'm like, geez, where is the guy? And then I realized a guy standing across the platform was actually him, and I hadn't recognized him because he'd gained a lot of weight, and he just looked very different. And it turned out after talking to him that the reason was a couple of years after we'd met in 1995, his career was doing really well. He was making some money, and he and his girlfriend went to Thailand for vacation. And he stepped off the curb, looked the wrong way because they drive on the left-hand side in Thailand, and he'd gotten hit by a bus, and it had almost killed him. And so he was, you know, had been in a coma for a while, and he was taking all kinds of different medications to sort of stabilize himself, and they'd caused him to gain some weight. So he had something of a sad twist, although I will say he has never stopped making music. He had a job in 2005 where he was doing raps for the chip maker Intel. So he played a couple for me. He would do these like presentations where he'd go and there'd be a crowd of people and he'd invite somebody to come down and say, I love Intel chips in Russian. And then he would incorporate that into a rap. So that was truly spectacular. So he's a good guy. He's a great guy.
Wish I had that clip right now. But here's the thing. Now, but you also had a kind of difficult conversations with him, or at least one difficult conversation that was repeated several times. And this has to do with the endemic homophobia in Russia that you encountered.
Yes. Well, I mean, I will say about the endemic homophobia, I will say the vast majority of people, because I'm actually gay, and so I came out to people on this trip. I did not in the first two trips, and I decided this time that I wasn't going to lie or obfuscate. Yeah. And so, but I would say that the vast majority of people that I told, and this includes people in tiny villages and people who, you know, told me they'd never met a gay person before, the vast majority of them said, I'm totally fine with it, but don't tell anybody else. And so I think there was a perception there that I could run into some trouble, which in fact I never did. And MC Pavlov, oddly enough, I mean, here's a guy who had actually traveled to New York. He'd been, you know, traveled around. He was a musician. And he had one of the more curious responses to it. He seemed just completely thrown by it. And I'm not really sure what that was about. But I also realized later that, you know, I didn't have any right to expect that, you know, him living in a society that he did, which was not particularly, you know, governmentally friendly to gay and lesbian people, that it wasn't probably very fair of me to expect that just because he'd been to New York in the 1980s, right, that he might feel differently than other people. So
did you were there other places or other times where you did feel a little bit insecure or in any way threatened for any reason?
There was one episode that I had on the train. You know, so the first two trips I traveled with photographers. So I'm traveling with guys, and it's, you know, you just feel safer, you know. And so this time I traveled as a woman by myself. And so I was a little nervous about that. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you think about is, you know, you're going to be on train trips that some of them are 1 or 2 days in length. And you don't really have any choice but to leave your stuff in the compartment when you go down to use the bathroom or go grab something to eat. And so I on one of the legs, I ended up in a compartment. They have 4 beds per compartment. And so I bought my bed, you know, my passage. And there was a young man in the compartment. It was only him and me. And that's kind of your worst case scenario, right? Because you think, all right, well, so what's going to happen here? What's this guy going to be like? And I'm trying to be cool about it. And almost as soon as I get into the car, the guy seems a little drunk. He's a young guy, and he gets up and pulls his pants off. And I think, okay, all right, so where are we going with this? And, you know, it was at night. I had boarded the train at night, and it's not uncommon for people to change into whatever they're going to sleep in. But normally they'll ask, you know, somebody of the opposite sex to leave the compartment. But he didn't. And so then I thought, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to go ask the conductor? What am I going to do? And almost as soon as he'd done it, he took a call from his girlfriend, and he spent the next 20 minutes talking to her and saying, my little darling, my sweetness, my love of my life, and blah, blah, blah. And it just got to be kind of amusing. And I thought, all right, I think this guy's actually fine. I think I'm all right. And he turned out to be fine.
Tell us about 2015, because you said things had gotten better, obviously, in the 10 years between 95 and 05, but then things turned the other way.
Yeah, right? So I would say it was 2015 fell somewhere in between the two, because in the 18 or so months between the beginning of 2014 and the fall of 2015, which is when I started the third trip, the ruble lost half of its value. So, you know, in the beginning of 2014, a dollar would buy 33 rubles. And by the time I landed, a dollar would buy 67 rubles. So this is not good for the Russian people, because a lot of what they purchase is imported from other places. And suddenly they can only buy half of what they could buy a year and a half earlier.
Forgive me for interrupting, but there's a lesson, a story in the book that speaks directly to that. Right?
Yes. Yeah. I had met a couple, a really lovely couple, who the guy had, you know, gotten a promotion at work. And he said, oh, I'm going to buy my wife a new car. And so he bought her a Mercedes, and he had to do it with a dollar-based loan, because the ruble does fluctuate. And so oftentimes when you buy a car like that, an imported car, you have to do it on a dollar-based loan. And he did that, and, you know, the ruble falls by half. So now he owes twice as much on that car than he expected he was going to. And that was really problematic for that family.
Now that our two countries are under the same government, the Trump and Putin administrations rule us both, are you going to do it again?
Trump-Putin? Hopefully, I mean, I am definitely planning to go back in 2025, you know, at that point. Yeah. By hook or by crook, there will be no more Donald Trump, because he can't stay in office that long, if nothing else. But it'll be very interesting to see how things have changed in another 10 years.
All right, so you're going to do it again.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we'll have you back. Lisa Dickey, author of the book Bears in the Streets, 3 Journeys Across Changing Russia, going to be at the Regulator Bookshop tomorrow at 7 o'clock. We have that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Frank. This was fun.
Coming up, filmmaker Nicole Trish takes us inside an old-fashioned roller skating rink with her new documentary, All Skate, Everybody Skate. Stay tuned.